Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife's Absite series. Today we'll be covering anesthesia. You've almost completed our entire series. In the next day or two, we'll be releasing our new episodes for this year, both thoracic and transplant, which were highly requested. I want to leave you guys with a quick motivational quote, as I know these days get long studying for the Absite. This quote is by Orison Swett Marden, who is actually a doctor at the turn of the 20th century and started a magazine called Success Magazine. His quote is, "Success is the child of drudgery and perseverance. It cannot be coaxed or bribed. Pay the price and it is yours." Okay, guys, pay the price and best of luck.
Okay, welcome back to Behind the Knife's Absite Review. I hope everybody's studying is going well and they're feeling confident. So we're going to jump right into it with a brief anesthesia review. So this is anesthesia for the Absite. Of course, not comprehensive, but this will hopefully pick you up a couple points. So we're going to get rolling. John, so let's talk about the ASA physical status classification for anesthesia. So that's the American Society of Anesthesiologists physical status classification. These are your ASA grades, 1 through 6. So I'm going to give you a patient. You're going to tell me what ASA they are. Okay? Ready?
All right, let's do it.
Okay, so let's say it's like you, a healthy patient without any disease.
I'm not sure if you know that, but that's ASA class 1. Jason, how about a patient with mild systemic disease, has very little impact on daily activity, and unlikely to have a major impact on anesthesia surgery? So people who have maybe well-controlled hypertension, asthma, they are cigarette smokers, but they don't have COPD and maybe mild obesity.
So that's ASA class 2. And I think what's important there when we talk about these is this is how it's going to come up on the outside. They're going to give you a patient. They're going to ask you what ASA class. So for ASA 2, important caveats to know is cigarette smoking automatically makes you ASA class 2, even if you're otherwise healthy and have no other medical problems. And if you're pregnant, that bumps you up to ASA class 2 as well, as long as those other things that John said. Okay, so John, let's say you have a severe systemic disease that limits normal activity. So let's say examples include stable angina, you had a prior MI, controlled CHF, or a kidney disease.
So that would be your ASA class 3. And the reason they have these as ASA class 3 is because these specific systemic diseases can likely have an impact on the anesthesia and surgery versus your ASA class 2, where they probably won't matter as much. Jason, for ASA class 4, what are the specific things that go along with that?
So class 4 is, this is your severe disease, but it's a threat to life and requires intensive therapy. So this will have a major impact on your anesthesiologist. So examples include end-stage renal disease, people on dialysis, people who are having an acute myocardial infarction, respiratory failure requiring mechanical ventilation, unstable angina, those type of things.
And I've seen these usually present these patients as their A lot of times they're urgent patients or emergent patients or patients who are already in the hospital that you need to operate on. So that might become clues to help you guide picking these if you're asked that question. For ASA class 5, Jason, what kind of patients fall in that category?
So the definition for ASA class 5 is basically a patient who's dying or is likely to die within the next 24 hours with or without surgery. And then John, the last category, ASA class 6.
Very rarely used in general surgery. I've never seen a question of this, but it's a brain dead or organ donor.
And then you add E to the end of that to indicate emergency surgery. So that's with your 4, 5, and 6, essentially. It's unlikely that you're going to be doing, surgery on an ASA class 4, 5, 6, unless it is emergent. Those are patients that need to be heavily optimized before doing an elective procedure on, obviously, for obvious reasons. Okay, John, so let's go through ACC, AHA guidelines for cardiac risk stratification for non-cardiac surgery. They break that up into high-risk surgery, intermediate-risk surgery, and low-risk surgery. What does that mean, and what kind of procedures fall into those different categories?
So these have been asked a few times. So let's start with our low-risk surgeries. These are the surgeries who people come in for: ambulatory surgery, hernia repairs, endoscopic procedures, any type of superficial lumps and bumps getting taken off, cataract surgery, and breast surgery also falls under the low-risk category. And that is reported a risk of cardiac death or non-fatal MI is usually less than 1% in the low-risk category. Jason, the intermediate risk category?
So these, again, non-cardiac surgery, intermediate risk would be, your carotid endarterectomies, any head and neck surgery, intraperitoneal intrathoracic surgery, so surgery in the chest or abdomen, orthopedic surgery, prostatectomies, those type of things are all considered intermediate risk. So reported risk of cardiac death or non-fatal MI, 1% to 5% with those intermediate risk procedures. And finally, John, high risk?
High risk surgery, essentially all your vascular surgery. Except for cardiac endarterectomy. So your aortic and other major vascular surgeries, and then also your peripheral arterial surgery minus carotid endarterectomy. And the reason they're high risk because the risk of cardiac death or non-fatal MI is actually quite often.
So John, who needs, you're seeing somebody in the clinic, you're preparing them for an elective procedure. How do you identify who needs a cardiac workup?
Well, you know how I usually present these patients in clinic? You just look at them and you kind of realize, oh man, that guy needs to see a cardiologist before surgery. But there are actually criteria for this. And so I'm going to read through these. A lot of these kind of make sense if you think about them. So any patient in angina, patient with a previous MI, patient has ongoing shortness of breath, heart failure, a patient who can walk has to walk less than 2 blocks due to shortness of breath or chest pain, a patient with FEV1 less than 70% are predicted, any patient with severe valvular disease, any patient with PVCs greater than 5 a minute, any patient with high-grade heart block, if their age is over the age of 70, any patient with diabetes, renal insufficiency, and then obviously any patients who fall into a high-risk category undergoing major vascular surgery, and that includes, remember, your peripheral and aortic repairs.
Yeah, so those are good kind of general guidelines for identifying patients that may need that, preoperative risk stratification, by either internal medicine or cardiology. And what this is all really doing is kind of assessing the patient's functional status. Because the functional status of the patient is a good predictor of both the cardiac and overall risk of the patient for surgery and hospitalization. And when we talk about functional status, we typically talk about it in terms of metabolic equivalence of task, or METs. So, John, what does that mean? What is a metabolic equivalent of task, or a MET?
Yeah, MET is an objective measure of the ratio of the rate at which a person expends energy to the person's mass while performing some specific physical activity compared to a reference, which is set by the conventional 3.5 milliliters of oxygen per kilogram per minute, which is equivalent to the energy expended while just sitting quietly, such as doing a podcast.
So, you know, when I'm seeing a patient in clinic, I'm trying to assess what their functional status is. And I'm typically doing this in terms of METs. So you look at what some different examples of some different metabolic equivalences, and a good cutoff, I think, for whether or not somebody needs a further workup or not is 4 METs. So if they can achieve over 4 METs, you can be pretty confident they're going to be able to tolerate a surgery. So when I think about examples of that, so what's less than 4 METs? So if the patient's unable to walk 2 blocks on level ground without stopping due to symptoms, that's poor. So that's an example of less than 4 METs. Greater than 4 METs, if a patient's able to climb 1 flight of stairs without stopping, or walk up uphill 1 to 2 blocks without getting chest pain or shortness of breath, that's pretty good. So that's a good question that I kind of screen patients with. Hey, are you able to walk up a flight or two of stairs without having to stop, without getting shortness of breath or chest pain? If they answer yes to that, then I can be fairly confident that they are able to achieve greater than 4 METs and are likely going to be able to tolerate. Of course, you have to take the whole patient and their other comorbidities and, like John said, those other things he talked about, and kind of the eyeball test as to determining whether or not somebody needs a further workup. But that's a good general rule of thumb, and it's good to be familiar with some different examples of what some different metabolic equivalents are.
Okay, Jason, now I want to move into the perioperative complications. So, Jason, what are the 2 comorbidities associated with the most postoperative hospital mortality?
So that would be preoperative heart failure and renal failure. And renal failure is actually the number one predictor of postoperative hospital mortality.
And one of the things that runs into perioperative complications is the need for reintubation, maybe urgently, either on the floor or in the ICU. And the typical steps that a general surgeon would need to do if they're doing intubation is a rapid sequence induction. So, Jason, can you describe the rapid sequence induction?
Yeah, this is a good one to be familiar with, both for real life and for the abside. The way this question is typically asked is they'll ask you which is the correct sequence, and they'll have A, B, C, D, E, and they'll kind of list these different steps in various orders, and you have to pick the one that's in the right order. So the steps of rapid sequence induction are, number one, oxygenation and short-acting induction agent. Number two, a muscle relaxant. Number three, cricoid pressure. Number four, intubation. And number five, the inhalational anesthetic. So again, oxygenation, short-acting induction agent, muscle relaxation, cricoid pressure, intubation, and inhalational anesthetic. John, how do you determine that you have achieved, you got the tube in the trachea, not the esophagus? What's the best predictor of that?
So the best determinant between the two, tracheal and esophageal intubation, is your end tidal CO2.
Perfect. Yep, that's exactly what the question is going to be. That simple on the test. What's the best determinant? End tidal CO2. Okay, so John, let's say you're in a case and anesthesia pokes their head over the table and said that they had a sudden rise in the end tidal CO2. What's the most common cause of that, and what are you thinking about?
So the most common cause is hypoventilation, and you would treat this with increasing your tidal volume and increasing your respiratory rate. Another thing that comes to mind, though, you must be concerned about is, and although very unlikely, is malignant hyperthermia.
Yeah, exactly. So a rise in end tidal CO2 during a case, most commonly due to hypoventilation, common things being common. But the more serious thing that you worry about is malignant hyperthermia. A little bit later, we're going to talk about how to handle that situation. But conversely, John, let's say anesthesia pokes their head over the curtain and they say that they had a sudden drop off of their end tidal CO2. What are you thinking about there?
So the most common cause in this situation is actually just disconnection of the tubing or off the ventilator. But then obviously you need to be concerned about a CO2 or air embolism. A CO2 embolism would actually be a transient rise in end tidal CO2 initially. It would be associated with hypotension, and then followed up by a massive drop in end tidal CO2.
Okay, so let's say you're in that situation, then you have, the anesthesia says they're hypotensive, their CO2 went up and now it just dropped off, and they're freaking out. How do you manage this?
So if you're in a laparoscopic case, you stop your CO2 insufflation, and this is most likely going to occur during a laparoscopic case. Stop the CO2 insufflation, allow the abdomen to decompress. You place the patient in Schoen-Doenberg in left lateral decubitus position, so your left side up, and then hyperventilate with 100% oxygen. And then if there is a concern, a lot of times you'll get an echo or something like that, but also you can aspirate off a central line if there's present. And if the patient is undergoing, has hypotension, you can start pressors, inotropes. And obviously if they're coding, then you start your ACLS protocol.
Yep, exactly. Again, you stop CO2 insufflation, you place the patient in the Trendelenburg with the, in the left lateral decubitus position. That's called the Durant maneuver. And that helps prevent air from traveling outside the right ventricle and prevents an airlock situation in the heart. Hyperventilate, 100% oxygen, aspirate the central line. You could try and get that CO2 embolus out of there. Pressor, you know, support them with pressors, inotropes if you need to, and CPR, prolonged CPR. Is key there. Okay, so moving on, let's move into some different anesthetic agents and some commonly asked questions. So we'll start with the inhalational agents. So we throw around this term MAC all the time. John, what do we mean when we say MAC with regard to inhalational agents?
So MAC stands for minimal alveolar concentration. It's the smallest concentration of gas at which 50% of patients will not move to painful stimulus.
Yeah, and that's a question on the upside. That simply, what's the definition of MAC? So that's 50% of patients will not move to painful stimulus. What are the implications of having a low MAC? What does it mean when an agent has a low MAC?
So when they have a low MAC, it means that the inhalation agent is more lipid soluble, which means that it's more soluble, more potent, but has a slower speed of induction.
Okay, so low MAC, more soluble, more potent, slow speed of induction. Which agent has the highest MAC?
And this is a question I've seen. Nitrous oxide, so it is less lipid soluble, it is less potent, and then has a high speed of induction.
Yep, perfect. So what situations would you not want to use nitrous oxide?
This comes up a few times. Pneumothorax, any patient with a pneumothorax, any patient with a small bowel obstruction, which is important in general surgery. You don't want to be putting them under nitrous oxide when they have a small bowel obstruction. Or any instance where there is an air-filled body pocket.
Okay, great. Let's talk about some side effects. So halothane is one of the more common, not commonly used, but more commonly asked side effects for inhalational agents. What are the side effects of halothane?
Yeah, I have trouble remembering all these a lot, so I tend to review them very close to the time of the test. But halothane, I think hepatitis, HNH. Halothane also can cause eosinophilia, jaundice, increased LFTs, which goes along with your hepatitis. And it has a high degree, halothane, high degree of cardiac depression and arrhythmias.
Yep. So halothane, I think probably the most common there is the liver, the liver injury, hepatitis with halothane is the one that I've seen most commonly asked. Let's anesthesia in kids. What is the best agent for mask induction in children?
I'm not entirely sure why this is, but sevoflurane. Jason, do you know?
Yeah, I think for several reasons. I'm by no means an anesthesiologist, but it's used across all ages. It's good in kids and adults. It's pretty, it doesn't have, it's less noxious. It has less associated with less nausea. It's quick on, it's quick off. It's pretty well tolerated. And it's, from what I've been told, I've never had it, but I've been told it's pretty sweet smelling. Okay, and the last inhalational agent we're going to talk about is isoflurane. What type of procedures are ideal for isoflurane and why?
So these are good for all of our neurosurgery procedures. It lowers the brain oxygen consumption, and it has no increase in ICP.
Great. Okay, so let's move on to the intravenous agents. So again, there's some common things that are you just kind of have to know about each of the IV agents that are frequently asked. So we'll just kind of go through these pretty quickly. So one thing that often comes up is somebody tells you they have an egg allergy. Which IV agent are you not going to use?
So that's propofol. Propofol is very rapid on and off. I think it's a pretty common agent to use for an intravenous agent. It can cause, and for local sedation as well, general sedation. It can cause hypotension and also respiratory depression as well. The one thing to note about propofol is not an analgesic.
Yeah, so some of these agents are going to have amnestic properties, some are going to have analgesic properties, some are going to have both. We'll try and mention those as we go through them if we can. But propofol, quick on and quick off, these used all the time, especially for patients that you need to do like neuro exams on, and you'd be able to wake them up from the neuro exam, put them down again pretty quickly.
I think it also is one of those ones that it can actually distribute into the fat as well. So you can actually have a propofol syndrome or infusion syndrome after it too. So you can have a prolonged release of propofol if it's used for a long period of time.
Great. Well, that's one of the questions I was going to ask you. So I guess I'll have to think of a different question to ask you about it. What's one of the major side effects?
And then propofol also can cause a metabolic acidosis along with the propofol infusion syndrome. It can cause hypertriglyceridemia and rhabdomyolysis.
Yeah, and that can be often fatal. It takes intensive supportive care.
All right, Jason. So which induction agent can cause adrenocortical suppression?
Yeah, so that one's etomidate. So etomidate has few hemodynamic changes and few cardiac effects. So it's good for patients that may be a little hemodynamically unstable, but it can cause adrenocortical suppression. It's often used for patients with heart failure and patients with angina. Okay, moving on. So, John, which induction agent doesn't cause any respiratory depression, but can be associated with hallucinations?
So this is a drug that's often good use in children. It's ketamine. Also used in combatant patients as well. But it's contraindicated, although I think this is controversial now, it's contraindicated in head injury patients due to increased cerebral blood flow.
Yeah, I think that's changing. I'm not sure if that's going to show up on the website. That used to be, kind of a classic association with ketamine is you can't use it in head injury patients, but there's some data coming out that says that you can. I think it's a great drug. It's an underutilized drug. So I'm not sure how I would answer that on the outside. Hopefully, they'll steer clear of it. I think a lot of people are giving ketamine in head injury patients now. So we'll just avoid that for now. How about Precedex? What's Precedex good for? What is it? Why do we use it?
Well, Precedex is probably one of my favorite drugs to use, especially in the ICU and patients coming out of intubation. It provides anesthesia and analgesia. It's easy to titrate, and this makes it very different than the other ones. The fact it can actually give you analgesia as well. It's not typically used as an induction agent. And then, like I already mentioned, it's good for early extubation protocols or weaning off any sedation.
Yeah, it can cause a little bit of hypotension, so you have to be careful of that, especially when you bolus it. But it's pretty amazing to like walk into the ICU and see somebody sitting up in a chair, intubated, looking completely comfortable on Precedex. It's a remarkable drug for extubation protocols. Okay, moving on. So we've covered our inhalational agents, we've covered our IV agents. Now let's talk about some paralytics, which are, there's not a whole lot you have to know about these, but there are some commonly asked things. So one thing that frequently shows up is the order of paralysis of muscles and, when things wake back up. So, John, during paralysis, what is the first muscle to be paralyzed and the last muscle to be paralyzed after administration?
Yeah, so I remember this, unless it's easy to remember for everybody else. I remember this is that, anesthesia is working at the head and neck, and I'm working down at the belly. So the anesthesia works its way down the belly to me. So the face and neck muscles are the first ones to be paralyzed after administration. And the diaphragm, where I'm working, is usually the last muscle. Conversely, if you think about when you're coming out of anesthesia, the diaphragm is the first to recover, and then the face and neck muscles recover last.
That's a pretty good way of remembering it. The way I always remember it is, what muscle do you need to keep you alive? And that's your diaphragm. So that's the one that's going to hang on the longest. That's going to be the last one to be paralyzed. That's going to be the first one to wake up.
That's probably easier.
So, John, which is the only depolarizing agent that can worsen hyperkalemia? It's a depolarizing agent that causes hyperkalemia.
So you should be immediately thinking of acetylcholine. So you don't want to use this in burn patients, patients with neuromuscular disorders, any patient underwent massive trauma, or any patient has renal failure with hyperkalemia or predisposing hyperkalemia.
So, John, we talked a little bit about malignant hyperthermia. We said we'd talk more about it. So succinylcholine can induce malignant hyperthermia along with a number of other agents. But how do we treat this?
So malignant hyperthermia is Well, the cause of it is a defect in calcium metabolism that causes a release of a significant amount of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And Jason, we already talked about this. What's the first sign of malignant hyperthermia?
The first sign, like we mentioned, is increased end tidal CO2. Now, back to my question, you're deflecting. How do you treat it?
So this is the dantrolene cooling blankets and then obviously continuing resuscitation.
Yeah, so massive amounts of dantrolene, cooling blankets, and resuscitation. This is one that's good to go through just from a practical standpoint. I know we did one recently in our hospital, but it's good to kind of go through with your anesthesia provider and have some mock scenarios where everybody knows where the dantrolene is, everybody knows how to mix it up, everybody knows how to give it. Because when it goes down, which rarely, you don't have time to kind of get the instructions out and read them. Let's talk about, we hear a lot about Hoffman elimination. Why is that important, and what agent is associated with Hoffman elimination, John?
So this is your cis-atricurium, and it can be used, it's used typically in patients with liver and renal failure, and you can get the metabolism within the bloodstream. So we talked about succinylcholine and cis-atricurium. Jason, how is rocuronium metabolized? And then also talk about pancuronium.
Okay, so rocuronium, pancuronium. So rocuronium is metabolized in the liver, and pancuronium is metabolized by the kidneys.
Do you know a way to remember that at all?
So the way I don't know how you remember it, but the way I remember it is I just picture the liver as a big rock. So the liver is a big rock, so that's rocuronium. And your kidneys make P, which starts with the letter P, which is pancuronium. Do you have another way?
Or is that... No, I like that, actually.
All right, yeah. So rocuronium, your liver's a rock. Pancuronium is released in your P. How do we reverse? So we're talking about these non-depolarizing agents. I don't know if we mentioned that, but you know, succinylcholine is a depolarizing agent. The rest of these are non-depolarizing agents. How do we reverse these non-depolarizing agents?
So that's acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. There is actually a new one too. I'm blanking on the name of it that they're all beginning to use now. Jason, do you know the name of that one?
I don't. Maybe we should pause the recording and look that up.
We should look that up.
One moment. Okay, we are back after the pause that you guys did not hear so that we could look up this new and exciting reversal of some non-depolarizing agents. And John, what is it?
So it's called Sugammadex. I call it the sugar. It is used for reversal agents and the non-depolarizing neuromuscular blocking agents such as vecuronium and rocuronium.
All right, there you go, Sugammadex.
It's the first selective relaxant binding agent.
All right, that will not be on the app side, I can almost promise you, but it's fun to know anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're done with paralytics. Moving on, let's talk about local anesthetics. Comes up pretty frequently. How do you dose them? You know, which ones you use? How long do they last? So in generally speaking, John, how do local anesthetics work?
So this takes us back to our medical student days. It blocks the transmission of signals by stabilizing your sodium channels, which increases your action potential threshold. So it increases the amount of sodium needed to create an action potential.
Okay. So more commonly used ones, bupivacaine, lidocaine, procaine sometimes, not frequently. In talking about how long these local anesthetics last, can you place those in order for me? Bupivacaine, lidocaine, procaine.
Yeah, so bupivacaine, marcaine, is the longest acting one. Lidocaine lasts the longest after that, and then procaine.
Perfect. Okay, so let's talk about some toxicities. This is another thing that frequently comes up. So lidocaine toxicity, what are the first kind of signs that somebody might be leading going into lidocaine toxicity?
So the patient's awake, the first sign would be perioral numbness or tingling, and they would talk about their lips tingling. Also, you can get CNS-related syndromes, seizures, and then arrhythmias, which is one of the common things they'll ask if the patient's already on the operating table. And Jason, there's two different types of local anesthetics, amides and esters. Can you tell us the difference between the two?
Yeah, so between amides and esters, esters are the more problematic ones. They're not that commonly used anymore, and that's due to they have a PABA analog, chemically speaking, And this causes increased allergic reactions and other issues. How do you tell it when you're looking at the name of a drug? Because sometimes they'll ask you, John, which of the following list is it amide or an ester? How do you tell the difference between the two? What's an easy kind of trick?
Well, the amides all have an I in the first part of the name and have two I's typically. So lidocaine, bupivacaine, mepivacaine, and like Jason already mentioned, they all have rarely cause allergic reactions. Your esters are your no I's in the beginning of the name, so tetracaine, procaine, and cocaine.
So the way I've seen that question asked is they'll give you somebody who has had an allergic reaction. So they give you a patient that got a local anesthetic and then they have allergic reaction. They'll say which one was most likely given. And so it's going to be the ester on that list. So you look at the one without two I's, the one that's not an amide, the one that's an ester, and that's your answer. Okay, so let's talk about dosing of local anesthetics. I think that the abside is actually getting away from a lot of math and a lot of having to figure out dosages of different things. This is one that might still show up because it's pretty easy to do in your head and it's very practical. So what are the doses, the maximal doses of the different commonly used local anesthetics, John?
So lidocaine itself without epinephrine is 5 milligrams a kilogram.
And how long does that, let's also talk about, you know, the duration. So like you say, lidocaine without epi, max dose, 5 mgs per kilogram. Yeah. And then tell me how long they last.
You can get up to about 60 minutes, 30 to 60 minutes of duration with these. Your lidocaine with epinephrine is a larger dose, 7 milligrams a kilogram. And that duration is up to 4 hours long. And then bupivacaine or marcaine is a smaller dose, 3 milligrams a kilogram, and you can get local anesthetic effects up to 15 hours.
Okay, great. So those are good ones to know. Again, plain lidocaine, 5 mgs per kilogram, lidocaine with epi, 7 mgs per kilogram, and then marcaine or bupivacaine is 3 mgs per kg.
And then moving on, the next few ones are just kind of talking about the most common, we're going to talk about opioids and benzos, but these are just very simple questions that you often see and mostly due to side effects. So for Jason, for the opioids, which opioid is associated with histamine release?
Yeah, so that's morphine. You get the itching, histamine release from morphine.
And then what is the metabolite of Demerol that can cause seizures?
So it's norepinephrine.
And then, obviously, what is the treatment over an overdose of opioids that EMTs are now carrying?
Yep, opioid overdose is Narcan. Okay, moving on to benzos. John, to flip it back on you, which benzo is contraindicated in pregnancy and why?
So, Versed is the one that's contraindicated in pregnancy, and it's because it crosses the placenta.
Side effects of benzos, what's most common? How do you treat?
So the most common is respiratory depression, and flumazenil, which is a competitive inhibitor, is the treatment of a benzodiazepine overdose. But then you don't want to use this drug in patients who have status epilepticus or any patient who has an increased ICP.
That's a great point. Yeah, mm-hmm. But your anecdote or your reversal agent for benzos, flumazenil, reversal agent for opioids, Narcan.
Yep.
Easy questions to miss or easy questions to get a couple easy points on there.
And then to wrap it all up, we're going to finish up talking about epidurals and spinals. And so, Jason, what's the first treatment of a patient who has a postural puncture headache?
So, headaches after epidurals, postural puncture headache, bed rest. You start with kind of bed rest, some pain medications, fluids. And then if that's not working, you can do an epidural blood patch.
Yeah, typically you lay them flat and let it see if it works. And about after 24 hours, it's still not getting better, then you want to consider the epidural blood patch. What can morphine cause in an epidural? If you're giving it in epidural, I mean.
Okay, yeah. So if you're adding, so if you have an epidural, it's important to kind of communicate with anesthesia as to whether or not you want them to add in an opioid as well, because it can cause some respiratory depression if that's in your epidural.
And we also use lidocaine in epidurals as well. And what kind of side effects can this cause?
So this is where you can see hypotension and bradycardia. So it's important to know if you have a, a patient that you just did a big whack on and they have an epidural and they're dropping the pressures, a lot of times they'll ask anesthesia to come turn it down, turn it off, adjust it, so you can distinguish whether or not it's the epidural causing that or whether your patient's bleeding. So it's important to know that side effect.
And finally, if you're having a patient with hypotension that is not, treated with just turning the epidural down, you still continue to have the problems related to the lidocaine, what is the pressor that we'd like to use?
So the pressor to treat hypotension related to the epidural, once I would say the caveat that you have to be sure that that's what's causing your hypotension. So make sure you rule out bleeding or other causes of hypotension in a postoperative patient. But if you're confident that it is purely your epidural, you want to go with something that's a peripheral vasoconstrictor. So that's your phenylephrine. All right, I think that wraps it up. That's our anesthesia review for the Absite. Again, everybody, I hope that studying is going well. I am completely confident that everybody listening out there is going to dominate the Absite this year. So take a break, go outside, get a little bit of exercise, come back in, and let's get started with the next one. Thanks for listening to Behind the Knife.